Okay. So I sent a bunch of mails yesterday, as well as I just want to go over them, and then we will continue with the search engine discussion. There was a survey, as those of you who took part in it know. I think there were about 8 people who gave the responses, and this, you can look at what has been said. It's right there. Okay, there's a link and unedited transcript of whatever was said. Essentially, I'll assume that, in democracy, elections are decided by people who show up. In classes, if there's a survey, the class is decided by people who take part in the survey. So I assume that the 8 people are the representation of the class, according to which I think we are, there were some questions that people wanted discussed, including the career paths. And so I sent a couple of mails yesterday, and I'll mention this right now in a minute. But otherwise, people seem to be thinking that they are getting something out of this, so we'll continue it this way. Regarding the careers stuff, as I mentioned, again, I could repeat what's in these in front of you, but I think it might actually be more useful if you spend some time looking at these resources and then either, ask questions on the blog or ask questions here. Either way is fine, That way, I would be answering questions that you may have as against the questions that I think you should have, which makes no sense. Because this is about careers, and, different people are interested in different kinds of things as to, what you want to do after the 4 years of computer science here. Again, to repeat this, I'm assuming that several of you already looked at these mails, but to repeat this, this computing careers is the main place where you get is the main ACM site, which has a whole bunch of information about it. It has a whole bunch of information about careers in computer science, including, mugshots of kids doing computer science, and ask them, why are you doing computer science, and they'll answer. So you kind of get a feel for why other people do computer science. And also, the different majors, what are the differences, and also what sorts of jobs are available. This is sort of an imposing site because it has a lot of information, okay? But you can keep this in the back of your head and come back to it anytime you need. And I also suggested that you look at, two 5-minute videos at your leisure. Especially those of you who actually have questions about, what sort of careers are there in computer science. Okay, if you already know, good for you. Okay, so this one, essentially, both of these are made by specific universities, so there's a bit of advertisement aspect to it. This one is made by Columbia, and this one is made by UW. This one actually specifically talks about Columbia. Please join our program and pay us out, your tuition dollars. But other than that, the specific jobs that they talk about, they are basically available for all computer scientists. And some of the directions that they mention, you may not have thought about. For example, Columbia being in New York, a whole bunch of their students actually go to Wall Street. And, we can take credit for the failure of the economic system just as much as the housing people, because a whole bunch of math, physics, and computer science people have made up these derivatives, which are incredibly hard to track as to, when does it go down versus go up. And so, you can take just as much of a credit for that, and you can make the kinds of money that Wall Street folks make, at least that you read about in the paper. Okay, so that's it's sort of a more traditional careers in computer science that this one shows. And this one essentially shows more off the beaten track careers in computer science. Okay, so that you can at least get a feel for. They have one guy working with NASA applications, and one guy working somewhere in remote Amazon jungles and all that fun stuff. Okay, so you will get a different feel for non-traditional computer science careers, more research-oriented ones. So between these two, you should have an idea, approximately. And then if you ask, for example, and as I mentioned at the end of this mail, if any of these things, if a particular line seems to be more interesting to you, like, for example, there is a particular research-oriented line that is more interesting to you, and you want to know what's happening in ASU, feel free to ask me either on the blog or an email or come to my office, and I would be able to connect you to at least give you the pointers as to who might be doing that kind of work here. Okay? So that's regarding the careers. And as I said, rather than just go through them or put the video on and miss it along with you, I'm thinking that you should watch it yourself. And you know, you all have iPods, and you know, you should be able to watch it. These are small 5-minute videos. Okay? Then the other thing is work, required exercise. It's not optional anymore. This one I want all of you to do. And essentially, in fact, one person, you know, one of the people in the comments actually asked that they want to know how to think like a programmer. Okay? So actually, it's an interesting question. In fact, is there something called programmer's thinking? And there is Jeanette Wing, who was the computer science department chair at Carnegie Mellon, and she became like the NSF, National Science Foundation's SCIFE division. The reason this is interesting is SCIFE is Computer and Information Science and Engineering division in National Science Foundation. Those are the guys who spend who actually fund a lot of research in computer science, and who also sort of decide directions. I mean, it's again a democratic process, but decide directions as to what, you know, where the research is going on right now. And she has been talking about this idea called computational thinking. And her idea is that, in fact, just as, you know, most of you were, I don't know, if you're actually in the honors college, you'll be forced to take glimpses of Western philosophy. Whether or not you will ever use the philosophy in your life, you have to learn how philosophers think, okay? And what Jeanette Wing, and you know, many people actually agree with her, says is there is such a thing called computational thinking. And whether or not you are a computer science person, okay, you still will benefit from understanding the, you know, what is involved in a computational thinking, okay? So again, that too, I want you to first take a look at, a write-up on the computational thinking and write your comments on it on the blog, and then we will discuss this as needed in one of the three remaining classes. Okay? As far as the slides are concerned here, essentially, you can pick, you know, different people learn differently, presumably. So this one is an article. This one is an article. It's like just a 4-page article. It's not directly written just for beginning undergrad students. It was written more in the CACM, which is one more acronym. CACM is Communications of ACM. And is anybody here? I mean, do all of you know what ACM is? ACM is Association for Computing Machinery. That's the name, that's what it stands for, and that's the main professional organization for computer science people. Okay, and in general, actually, I believe there is like a campus ACM subchapter and so on. And as I said, the computing careers that I showed you earlier, that was being organized by ACM. It's the main association. You can get CACM, you can look it up online, and CACM is sort of easy to read articles about current trends in computer science. Okay, that's basically the communications of this professional association. Okay, so you know, for example, Nature. Have you heard of Nature, the scientific magazine? Or Science, the scientific magazine? CACM is ACM's version. Each professional society tends to have like a flagship communication magazine, which is supposed to be read by everybody, I mean, which can be read by everybody in the area, not necessarily just the researchers. Okay. And so she was writing it to other computer science people as to what she thinks is computational thinking and why everybody can benefit from it. And this is probably not surprising, especially if you look at the career paths thing, you'll notice that everybody needs people. I mean, everybody needs people who have access to computational thinking. So if you're a biologist, there is so much mountains of data being created right now that analyzing that data requires computational expertise. And either you can hire somebody, or increasingly what you might actually need are people who have computational background plus some other background so that they can do that other thing. Okay? And so she was actually arguing for that, and in fact she gives examples of how computer science thinking has changed some of the other disciplines apart from just making Intel and Motorola and Google, which you would probably know anyway. Okay, so that's like a four-page article you can read. Equivalently, you can read slides. I don't know whether you like slides or the slides basically are like 68 slides or something. So there are slides there, you can look at those, okay? Or finally, if you prefer to see her in person, there is a 65 minute talk of hers that's available, okay, on this exact idea. This is actually, wow, that's nice. I'll get more students at this rate, okay. IHMC is a place where she was actually giving this talk, and they recorded it and put it up. So you could use any one of them. All I want you to do is read either of these sources. Do not have to do all of them. If you want, you can look at all of them, and they will be slightly different from each other probably, but the main ideas will be the same, and I want us to discuss. I mean, I want you to have an opinion on whether or not this thing sort of makes sense. You know, do you really believe that there is something called computational thinking? Do you buy her arguments? Do you not buy her arguments, etc.? Okay? Any questions on this stuff? Okay. So that is a required participation thing for the class. So those were the mails I had sent. Okay. So, I'm going to get back to what we were doing, and actually this would be the last discussion class for the search, that search engines, and then we will move on to something else next time. I haven't quite decided. If in fact, as I said, if you have specific questions on careers after looking at those resources, and if you have specific questions on computational thinking after reading this stuff, you know, you post them on the blog, and if I find that it would be more useful to discuss them in the class, I'll do that. Okay. So I can always shift what we need to do in the class. If I don't have anything else like that, then I would rather do some technical stuff and see if you can get some of it, you know, for later use. Okay. So we were looking at search engines, and I think the last thing we said in the last class is you could also think of string matching, you know, spelling correction in terms of K-grams, where K-gram is a K-contiguous character sequence. And then, so this string then becomes these many 3 grams, and a slightly misspelled version of that string becomes a different set of 3 grams, except there are enough 3 grams that are actually common between them. Okay, and so if two strings are close enough, then they will have enough 3 grams common. And so when you give this one to Google or any search engine, it will look into its dictionary to see if it has, we'll talk about what's called an inverted index. It'll look into the inverted index to see if there are any documents that have this word in it. Okay, if there are not enough documents which have this word in it, then it will basically realize that maybe you misspelled the word that you wanted to search for. Because, you know, at a search engine level, it's highly unlikely that, you know, you are looking for something for which there isn't even a single document available. Okay, so if there are too few documents available that match your word, then they will do something like this very quickly. They try to see whether the word that you have typed is close enough to some other words in the dictionary. Okay, and if so, then, and the way they decide the closeness is techniques like this. It's not the only technique, you know, this is one of the techniques that could be used. Okay, so the overall idea as to how search engines could work is this. So when you give a query, you know, you may have given a set of words as a query, then the query is, you can think of that as a query itself as either a bag or vector of words, and we looked at both models. Okay, and then every document that the search engine has ever crawled, you know, so search engines crawl the documents and then index them somewhere, all these documents are also seen as vectors of words. And what you're trying to compute is between your query and every document in the big document corpus. Okay, corpus is just the big list of documents that search engines maintain. Which are the ones that are close in terms of, if you go with the vector similarity, which are the ones that are close in terms of the cosine theta metric, which is what they try to do. Okay, of course they have to do this in under milliseconds, because people get mad if they don't get their answers back in under milliseconds. Okay, so technically, conceptually, there isn't that anything that hard here, which is, if you understand how to compute a similarity between two documents, you can think of query itself as a document, and then another document and this query, how close are they, and then, you know, rank the documents in terms of their closeness to the query and show the top 10 in the first page. That's what they try to do. Okay. Now, of course, the problem is you have to do this very efficiently, because depending on who you, you know, depending on the search engine you're looking with, they all like to advertise that they have indexed billions of documents, right? I mean, Google, I think, used to say 8 billion documents, now maybe more, and Bing probably has similar numbers, okay? So the question is, if I'm going to write a piece of code that takes my query and each document as a bag of words and computes the vector similarity, even though each computation is not too costly, you have to do 8 billion of these, okay? Which you can do over a day and then ask the guy to come back for the results, but then they'll never come back to your search engine again. So what you need to do is do this extremely fast. Okay, so what we'll do in the next few minutes is get a feel for how to do these things extremely fast, and that's also, again, a computer science idea, because efficient data structures is what you will learn. You started learning, presumably, in 101, and you will do it in 210 and 310, which is, you know, essentially how to manage large number of, you know, entities of the same kind, in this particular case, documents. Okay, so the idea that you do is a simple idea enough. If you have a textbook and you're trying to look for whether or not this textbook talked about some idea called vector similarity. Okay, one idea is open the first page, look the whole page to see if there's vector similarity anywhere. Then open the second page, then open the third page. Do any of you do that? Obviously not. What do you do instead? What? You look at the index, right? Okay, so you go to the index. So, and in fact, believe it or not, you know, have you ever thought about the following issue, that not every book has an index? Okay, if you buy a novel, novel doesn't have an index. Okay, and sometimes you might want to know, in the Harry Potter number 7 book or number 5 book, you know exactly something was said in a particular case, and you're looking for the exact quote. What do you do right now? You have to look at the entire book, or hope that somebody on the internet already indexed it. Okay, if they had an inverted index, an index the way your textbooks have, it would make life much simpler. Okay, so it's a very simple idea. An index, what you call an index in the textbook, is actually called an inverted index. Because you remember that textbook essentially has two kinds of indexes. The first one is called the contents, right, which says chapter 1 is this, chapter 2 is this, chapter 3 is this. That's what you look at to get an overall idea of how the book is organized. But that's, whereas you also have this second piece, which is inverted index, which is much more useful if you know what you're looking for. Okay? If you know what you're looking for, you go to the inverted index, you know, and then look for the page in which those words appear. So what I need to do essentially is to construct an inverted index for all the documents that I have. I mean, if I am the search engine, I have to construct an inverted index for all the documents that I've ever crawled. Unlike a textbook which comes in edition 1 and then for 2 years it doesn't change, and then edition 2 and one more 2 years it doesn't change, a search engine, the document corpus is changing constantly, right? Because they keep crawling every page lots and lots of times. And I might change my page and now it suddenly starts having, it starts to realize that my page contents have changed and that the inverted index now for a particular word also has to point to this page. Okay. Yeah, I don't know whether you noticed this or not. In the beginning of the semester, if you asked RAW ASU101 to Google, you wouldn't get the ASU101 homepage. But right now, if you say, it already is on the top. Okay. Why? Because it keeps crawling my page, and then it, you know, changes its inverted index. Okay. So this brings up, so first the idea of inverted index, it's not too surprising. So if I have like these documents, then basically I can just say that here are the forward index. The forward, so basically start from here and I can generate a structure like this which says the word entry occurs in this document, occurs in positions 11, 20 and 31. Positions are just the word positions. Texts normally give you the page position. That's because they assume that you don't know how to count the words on the page. It's too painful for you. So if it's a large enough page, you'll say this word appears in 277th page and you go there and you'll spend about 10 minutes looking for that word. You don't have 10 minutes, you know, when you have the query in front of you in the search engine's case. It needs exact position. But that's okay. We will spend time. There is this idea called amortization, which is basically, which is what the whole point of sorting is. You understand sorting, right? Why do you sort? I mean, I'm pretty sure, you know, all of you while growing up, especially the men and boys in the room, were yelled at by their mothers and fathers saying, why aren't you keeping your room clean? You know, you'll never find what you're looking for. You say, I'll find it. You know, I'll just throw the whole thing around and then last minute I'll start searching for it. The point of sorting is if you put them in their places, then when you look for them, you'll find it very quickly. But sorting, while you are sorting, you find as if you're wasting your time. That's time that you could have spent on, you know, Facebook, right? It's basically, there is no actual problem right now. Why am I making my house clean? It's only amortized. The work that you do while sorting is only amortized if you keep searching this room many, many times. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so if I have a list of things, if I have a list of things and I'm trying to find whether a particular thing is in this list, and if I'm going to do it just once in my life, there's no point in sorting because you will just do linear search. Start from here, look next, 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 next until you find that thing or you run out of the list. And that would do n comparisons if n is the number of things in the list. If you decided to first sort it and then search, then after you sort, you can search it in normally either log n or actually O1, if depending on if you do hashing or binary search. These are ideas that you'll hear pretty soon in next class in either 101 or 210. Okay, but to get this, you need to first sort the information that you have. And that takes n log n at least. And so you would say, if you're just doing the search once on this list, your friend just who searched it linearly did better than you who spent n log n plus one more log n, which is extra time. Okay? However, if you're going to search this many, many, many times, you would be way ahead of your friend if you had taken the time to sort it. Inverted index is the exact same idea. If your Google is going to get one search problem in its life, then wasting its time doing the inverted index is useless. But it gets like a millions of search problems per day, and each time it has to search the entire corpus, and so it's better to spend this time upfront and index words so that you know where individual words are. So given a word, I want to know what document the word is in and what position the word is in. Okay? So that's basically, you know, this is something that search engines do all the time. This is like one of the big things that they do, which is they go, they crawl your pages. And by the way, crawling pages basically means that they'll send a request to find the contents of your page, and then they'll take it home and then either cache it and then convert it into this index. Now, one of the interesting questions is also how many times do you cache? How many times do you crawl a particular site? Okay, so for example, think about the following thing. The United States Constitution is available online. Exactly how often do you think Google should be crawling that document? One of the nice things about staying in a country where Constitution doesn't change that often is that it doesn't change that often. So you should not be wasting time crawling United States Constitution more than maybe once in 3-4 years, as far as I'm concerned. Okay? If it is changing too fast, then you are in big trouble anyway. You know, okay? Whereas on the other hand, the blog page of this class changes a little faster than that. Although sometimes I feel it's changing too slowly, but it changes fast enough that it should be looking at the blog page more often than it looks at the United States Constitution. Okay? So in fact, deciding the relative frequency of crawls for various sites is itself an interesting computer science problem, because you're trying to decide which are important pages and how often do they change. And the number of times you hit a site depends on a combination of both. If it's a useless page that changes every 3 seconds, it's not worth crawling. If it's a very important page, such as Constitution, that does not change, you know, often enough, again, it's not worth crawling it too often. If it is sort of a medium important page like our class blog, and it also kind of changes with medium frequency, then you decide how often to crawl. Okay. One thing that you can figure out about your own, you know, how many of you actually have freestanding web pages as against one of these Facebook pages? Okay. So one way you can figure out whether Google thinks you are important or not is put something on your page and then keep checking whether your page comes up as a result to that particular word, you know, and if it doesn't, I mean, obviously you have to check it across the, you know, across the results. And if your page is not important, then Google doesn't crawl it too often, and so it might take like 2 months before it realizes that your page content has changed. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay, so, and when it finds that, then it you know, if the word doesn't change, it computes one inverted index, which essentially says for this word, these are all the documents in which the word occurs, and this is the exact position where the word occurs. And if the word is changing, then the inverted index has to be dynamically recomputed. Okay, much of what search engines do really is actually maintaining this inverted index and crawling and maintaining the inverted index. Okay, and one issue really is that this index, you know, you would think that for your textbook, so the textbook is like this big, the index part of the textbook is maybe only that thick, right? For the entire World Wide Web, the index is really, really huge. Of course, the web is huge, but so is its index, huge. Okay, a big issue becomes, how do you efficiently generate the inverted index, and how do you store it on pages such that, A, first of all, the index is distributed over multiple machines, and B, you always have one copy of the index available. Okay, imagine you're running a search engine and you only have one copy of the entire inverted index, and that machine goes down. Then it doesn't matter. Basically, as the queries come, you have no clue as to which documents have this word. Okay, so one thing that is done, and again, I don't expect you to understand this, I'm just trying to give you an idea that a lot of the action in actually doing search engines is distributing this large index, which is basically, think of your textbook's inverted index, which is the end of the textbook, itself as 18 volumes of books. And everybody wants to keep looking at them every millisecond, every microsecond. So you want them to be distributed over many machines, both because they won't fit on one machine and because you don't want the entire thing to come to a screeching halt because one important machine came down. Okay, so you need fault tolerance and you need the ability to store it over multiple places. So for example, this one actually, and then one other interesting thing is as the new documents are coming in, think about the normal way inverted index is made. You need to, if you wrote the textbook, you need to first figure out where all the words are in each page. Okay, and then after you get all the words in each page, then you get the inverted index saying for the word A, it appears in these pages and in these positions. So normally the way I said this, it's like it requires you to go through the entire document corpus first before you start constructing the index. But that's a big bottleneck when corpus keeps changing all the time. So what you need is ideas like this where as things are coming in, they're essentially putting them into bins. You know, here is like a part of the inverted index for words A to F. This is for G to P. This is for Q to Z. And the inverted index is never completely correct because the documents keep changing. Sometimes Google will show you a page because it thinks the word that you're looking for is on that page. When you look in that page, there is no such word because people change it after the crawl. And sometimes, more often, so when that happens, by the way, remember we talked about precision and recall? When Google shows you a page where you are hoping that a particular word you are looking for is on that page, and it's not there, what went down, precision or recall? Precision. Okay? Now, the other thing can also happen. You know, suddenly there are a bunch of pages which actually have this word, but Google only did indexing yesterday night, and it all happened like this morning, many, many pages started talking about a particular word, you know, when news cycle starts, okay? Then what happens? Google will not be able to, I mean, when I say Google, any search engine, will not be able to find you pages which have those words. That affects recall. Of the two things that get affected, if precision is affected, you actually can at least realize that it got affected because you see the page and you say, hey, the thing that I'm looking for is not in this page. Why did you waste my time? If recall is affected, on the other hand, you would not know. Because you don't know whether, you know, you assume that Google knows all the pages, and so if it didn't give you some pages, that means it's not there. Okay? Okay, so in fact, you know, you heard about server farms, right? Some of you have heard about server farms. Okay? Why are the server farms needed? Because they want to maintain these large indices over tons and tons of machines, okay, in a distributed fashion. While keeping fault tolerance. That means so that if one machine goes down, you just act as if nothing happened. Okay, and one of the actual claims to fame, you know, I think I have mentioned this, I don't know whether I mentioned this in this class or not, but I mean, every company wants to have a particular motherhood and apple pie as to the reason for its success. Coca-Cola keeps saying their reason for this success is their secret formula that is stored in SunQuest Bank in a real serious vault in the middle of Atlanta. Okay? And they say that's the real secret formula. That's why all of you guys are addicted to Coke. Okay? But really, that's not the reason. It's a slick advertisement campaign. That's what ultimately made it happen. And Google would like you to believe that it's the page rank, which many of you may have heard of, and we'll talk about a little bit later, is the reason why their search engine is extremely good. But really, the reason the search is extremely good is this. And the true secret, you know that a company is actually dependent on a particular technology if they don't even want to talk about it, right? And Google, for the longest time, would not tell you how big their server farms are and how many places are the server farms. And the idea is, let everybody who hears like the first two lectures in this series say, yeah, I too can make a search engine. I know vector similarity, I know how to compute this. And then, you know, you start a company, you fail, because what happens is, at a web scale, at a full scale, you need essentially this infrastructure. The thing that keeps Intel and Motorola in business is what? Their fab facilities, not their smartest engineers, You know, lots of other people also have smart engineers, but they sunk capital and generated huge, big fabrication facilities. And anybody who comes into fabrication of semiconductors is at a natural disadvantage because these other guys have already built these things. The thing that Amazon has going for it is what? It's automated warehouses. Back in 2000s, when many of you are in probably elementary or middle schools, we used to have this thing called internet bubble. And you know, every possible company which says we too have an internet division, its stock will go up many, many fold. And when that happened, Amazon essentially used all its capitalization to build huge, huge warehouses. Their warehouses are so mechanized that if one particular book in like a 15th row, 19th column has become empty, there will be an email sent to somebody saying, get some more of those copies. Any of you bought stuff from Amazon? Right? I mean, the thing that makes you go back to them is essentially the slick logistics. You know, they'll tell you exactly how many hours you have to click buy button so that you can get it delivered tomorrow, for example. Okay? This stuff requires, again, infrastructure buildup, which, you know, which is not as sexy because I can't teach you this in like a single algorithm in a day, but, you know, does it look like you would be interested in working in a server farm? You know, that looks like slave farm kind of a thing, you know, just for computer scientists. But those are the things that make, you know, search engines work very fast. And you need to understand that too, and you will hear about it when you think in terms of, when you take database courses, distributed operating systems courses, and also there is a course on search engines that is offered. You could, you know, learn more about those there. Okay. Any questions before I continue for a couple more ideas about search engines? Okay. Another idea is whatever I have said till now mostly did not take web into account except this slide. The web, this slide essentially said the index keeps changing. The documents keep coming in and going out, and so managing the index itself is a big issue. Let's talk about one other issue, which is, you know, when we considered the vector similarity, we looked at our bag similarity. We looked at words in the documents and either did the vector similarity in that space or bag similarity in the space of words. One question that you should have, and this is actually beyond web, it's not just for web, it's for any you know, search over documents, is should all words be considered equally important? Okay? And to get that into perspective, think about the following. I have three documents here. One document says the esoteric program for the computer. That's all that document says. The second document says the Fortran program for the computer. And the third document says esoteric program. Okay, now suppose this is your query. The first one is the query, let's say. The question is this more similar to this or this? On one hand, obviously it's not identical to either of them. Okay, now if you compare this to this, it has the word program common, the for common, the common, computer common. Right? Lots of words are common between this and this. One, I mean, in fact, also the. So one, two, three, four, five words common between these two documents. Whereas if you compare this document to this document, only two words are common. Agreed? Which would you say intuitively is actually more similar? Forget about the numbers. What do you think is more similar? The last one. Why do you think so? Is esoteric. Esoteric is actually esoteric because very few people even know the word and they don't use it. Okay? And so very few, if you are really looking, so for example, if I said, I am looking for a person who has three eyes and wears a shirt and a pant and a pair of shoes and has hair and has 10 fingers. That's what I said, right? So all of you here would basically look, would match my request except on the three eyes part, okay? But then there may be this other guy who has three eyes, does not wear a pant, maybe wears shorts, does not wear a shirt, maybe wears, you know, one of these, you know, undershirts, and, you know, has, you know, has a bald head. Who am I going to be more satisfied with? If I'm looking for a three-eyed guy, that's the most interesting part to me. Right? Do you understand what I'm saying? So if in my query I said three-eyed guy, right, that's very, very important. If everybody has a particular property, it's a useless property. Okay? How many of you know the story of Alibaba and the 40 thieves, right? So remember, as part of the, you know, you should watch Walt Disney movies once in a while. So in Alibaba's story, there was this time when these guys, the bandits, come and they're going to actually catch, you know, Alibaba. So what they decide is they come in the morning and put a cross on his home, on door of his home. The idea is in the night they'll come back and look for the door with the cross, and then they know that's the one where he lives, and, you know, go start doing, you know, gang style shooting, right? What happens in the story? You decide. So Alibaba's girlfriend goes around putting a cross on everybody's door. The moment everybody has the same cross, the cross speciality is gone. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if you think you're special because you got a particular t-shirt from Grand Canyon, I can put you in your place by making everybody wear the exact same t-shirt tomorrow. Then you'll look like one more of the bozos wearing the same t-shirt. Right? Right? So the point I have is this. When I ask a query, it's not the case that all words are created equal. What matters is how many people, how many documents have that property. In the previous case, when I was looking for a guy with three eyes, a shirt and a pant and hair, etc., if you ask yourself, what percentage of random humans have shirts? Close to 90%. What percentage of random humans have pants? Close to 90%. What percentage of random humans have three eyes? Close to 0%. So clearly, three eyes is much more important part of the query than the rest of the stuff. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? And so what you need to realize the relative importance of words is not just the frequency of the word. So for example, I'm looking for somebody with a shirt. And here is one guy who has eight layers of shirts. And here is one guy who has just one shirt. Clearly, if nothing else is different, then I like the eight-layer shirt guy, because supposedly I'm into shirts and this guy has lots of them. Okay? But on the other hand, so that's the frequency of the word. It's called term frequency, TF. I'll explain to you why I wrote TF in a minute. Okay? That is important. You kind of knew this. Pretty much the vector similarity takes into account how many occurrences of a word are in a document. The bag similarity takes into account how many occurrences of that word are in the document. What they don't take into account is how many other people have the same word anyway. If everybody, every document has that word, it's a useless word. The word the is a useless word in English. Okay? Unless, you know, Indians writing English like me write English prose, the is present in every essay. Okay? If I write an essay, I remove the because I don't think it's a useful word. So you may be able to tell whether or not somebody, you know, the guy writing this is an Indian by looking for paucity of the word the. But mostly it is useless in distinguishing one document from another. Okay? And so to be able to do that, you want to get inverse document frequency of every word. Given a word, you want to compute the percentage of the documents in your collection that have that word. The smaller that percentage is, the more important this word. That's why I want inverse document frequency. Okay? And one of the most important ideas in search engines and in search in general is this idea called TF-IDF. And in fact, if you just go to the web and say TF-IDF, you'll get a billion hits, all describing to you how search engines work. Okay, so all search engines, before they start comparing documents, have in essence computed not only the number of occurrences of a word, but also how common those words are. There is a Farsight cartoon. How many of you know Farsight cartoons? Okay, good. I'm generally happy that at least one or two people seem to know a reference that I try to make. But in the Farsight, there was this one cartoon where Vern the cow one day leaves his home. You know, her home. You know, if you know Farsight, you know Farsight is all about these animals, strange animals. Vern the cow leaves her home one day, saying, "Bye, mom, bye, pop, and I'm going to join the local zoo." And then the side heading says, Vern doesn't realize that as an animal, he's way too common. Zoos don't have cows, except for, you know, loser kids who want to do farm animal stuff, okay? Mostly zoos have pandas, because we have no pandas here, okay? Why would you have cows and rats in a zoo? They're just too common. And especially bed bugs, which are apparently everywhere now, okay? So the thing that makes you unique is that nobody else is like you. You have a property that nobody else has. So the importance of a word is computed in terms of the inverse of the frequency with which it occurs in the whole document space. Okay? And if you take that into account, then you will realize this is more closer to this than to this. And in fact, you will realize that the word "the" has basically zero weight, because it appears in every document. So if you actually ask Google, try this, you know, search for "the," it would tend to tell you, you know, get a life, look for something more useful. Okay. What's more interesting is if you search for "www," which turns out to be a very, very important conference about research going on World Wide Web. Okay. Most of the time, Google would say, you know, get a life. Because every page has .something. And so it's assuming that it's too common a word. And there is no way it actually can answer the question about .. Okay? So anyway, what you wind up doing is, if a word occurs in the current document 20 times, and its inverse document frequency is 0.1, then its effective weight is only 0.2. And that's what you use in the vector similarity, rather than 20. Okay. One other point, of course, is actually when you compute the inverse document frequency, you take a log. That's not to just, you know, give you any nightmares about logarithms. It's just that, so you take number of documents in the corpus divided by the number of documents that contain that word. Typically, it can be a huge number. So 8 billion by, suppose I were to make a really crazy word which nobody else will have, okay, and then basically one document out of 8 billion documents has this word now. So its IDF is going to be 8 billion by 1, that means it's 8 billion. So that just completely kills every other word, because if you multiply frequency by IDF, then the IDF number becomes too big. So you take a logarithm. And the advantage of the logarithms is they grow much slower, but they are monotonic with respect to the quantity you are tracking. So logarithm of this quantity will also grow as this is growing, but it grows much slower. Okay? So we have to stop here. It's 10:30. Make sure that you read the computational thinking thing.